All right, so this is Bio 241, and it is October 28th, Tuesday. We're going to maybe finish up the sensory system tonight. Hopefully. But you have lab later, don't you? So we can't run late tonight, can we? All right, don't forget, next time we have a test over what? 7, 8, 9, mm-hmm. But not 10, right? Chapter 7, 8, and 9. So are there any questions regarding that right now? No questions? Good. I'm glad. I hate questions. No, I'm kidding. Okay. So you need an 882E Scantron next time, good eraser, pencil, and you should be ready to go, and I'll grade the test right afterwards so you can kind of see what score you have, and you can look over the test. And you can also look it over next Tuesday, too, if you have to leave right after the test. All right. Well, does anybody have any questions over senses so far? That we've been talking about. How could we group all senses in your body? We could group them into two categories.
Peripheral and autonomic?
Nope. Peripheral and autonomic. Don't know if I like that so much. I'd rather do... Those are nervous systems, but not for senses necessarily. Those are two things. Oh, I think I heard something over here that I liked. Special senses and... And general senses, yeah, special and general. So what senses are general in our body? What are some senses that are general? I hear, taste, hearing, I don't like those. Nope, not for general. General means, well, let's just say what it means first. And then, okay, general just means that you have receptors all over your body for those particular sensations. So what can you sense all over your body?
Touch,
pressure, temperature, pain, okay, tickling, and there's a strange one that you can feel all over your body. It's not a somatic sense because somatic means on the surface of your body. It's a deeper sense, but nonetheless, you have it all over your body. It's nociception is pain. Nociception is pain, so that's in general. So you have pain receptors on the surface of your skin, and you have deep nociceptors too. But there's something called, starts with a P. Proprioception. Proprioception is a general sense. And proprioception gives you the sense of body position, angulation of joints, muscle tension, tension in tendons, and ligaments. All right? And so... That's a general sense because you have thousands of these receptors all over the place.
Where do we have that?
You don't have proprioception? Oh, you must have proprioception in your notes someplace. You don't see it? Okay, I'm going to go back and take a look. Here, cutaneous and proprioceptors. Okay, so that's a general sense. Proprioception is a general sense. Where else do you have it? Maybe just on that one slide.
What slide was that?
Because I don't have it. Yeah, here we go. Let me find it again. Right here. Slide 10-21. Sensations include from the cutaneous region and proprioceptors. Proprioceptors. So proprioception is a general sense because you have these sensors all over your body, like muscle spindles, Golgi tendon organs. We're going to talk about those, I think, when we get into the muscle chapter in particular, but they're proprioceptors. All right, now what about special senses?
Smell.
Why do you say smell is special? That's right. You only have one place in your body. You can't smell all over your body, just your nose and your eyes. That's special. Hearing is special. Taste is special. As well as balance, two kinds of balance that we're going to look at today, static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. These are two different kinds of balance that your body maintains for you, and those are in your ears, so that's special as well. Okay, so we were just getting to talk about, I lost the slide that we were starting to talk about. Where was it, right here?
1028.
Ah, right here, okay. Let me fix my pointer. Before we go on. Okay, so another name for the sensation of taste is called the? It's gustatory. Gustatory, right here. Taste or gustation is the sense of taste. All right, so in order for you to taste something, some kind of molecule has to dissolve in saliva, and then it has to bind to a special receptor cell. And in particular, it's got to bind to maybe a receptor on a taste hair. So here we have a bunch of taste hairs that are poking up off of this gustatory cell or a taste cell. And this whole structure right here, which includes the gustatory cells plus supporting cells plus some nerve fibers that go to it, to each one of these gustatory cells, this is what we call a taste bud. And I think maybe we were talking about this last time, because what do you see right here? Do you see like thousands of millions of cells, or maybe 5 or 10 cells? Yeah, just 5 or 10 cells. So this is greatly magnified, right? So in order to see this structure right here, can you just look at it with your naked eye? No, you need a microscope to see it. So a taste bud is microscopic in structure. You can't see that with your naked eye, but if anybody has ever stuck their tongue out at you, you can see little bumps on the tongue, which commonly people call taste buds, but are those taste buds? No, because taste buds are microscopic. What you see are actually what we call papillae, and papillae have thousands of taste buds all over the surface of them, right? So a taste bud is microscopic. Even though they might contain 50 or 100 cells each, they're still nonetheless microscopic. So that molecule has to dissolve in saliva, enter the taste pore, and bind to something that's almost like a cilium or a microvilli on this apical surface of that gustatory cell. And we have 5 basic taste sensations. And maybe we did talk about this last time. Sweet, sour, bitter, amino acids. And the amino acid taste is, I guess, stimulated by glutamic acid. And that sense is called umami, which is the sense of deliciousness. Okay. So here are some taste cells. Now the taste cells themselves are more of an epithelium kind of cell rather than a nervous system cell. And you can see the taste hairs right here. All right, for the sensation of salty, we see that there is a protein in the membrane of this projection or the process coming off the cell that is a sodium channel. So what the heck is salt? It's sodium chloride, right? So when you put salt on your food and you eat salt, you load your mouth with sodium, and that sodium dissolves in your saliva, and it goes through this sodium channel, right? And when it goes through the sodium channel, what happens to the resting membrane potential? Yeah, depolarized. You got to be really familiar with that Thursday, right? Sodium entry in the cell, that's a stimulus, right? That causes depolarization of that cell, right? So that wave of depolarization then affects the resting membrane potential at this distal part of the cell, more basilar part of the cell. And these are voltage-gated calcium channels. They open up. Don't forget calcium is high on the outside, so calcium rushes inside the cell, even depolarizes the cell some more. But even more importantly, this calcium is a signal for the fusion and docking of these neurotransmitters, which are released or exocytosed into this synapse. And this is an excitatory neurotransmitter, so that means it's going to cause depolarization on this gustatory nerve. All right, that goes to the brain. And then you will have the sensation of saltiness, right? And you have the sensation of saltiness not because this cell depolarized, but it's because of that part of the brain depolarizes. So if you artificially depolarize that part of the brain, what is the sensation you will have? Will you see something or hear something or taste something? And in particular, what will you taste? Salt, even though you don't have anything in your mouth, right? Because your sensation is purely determined by what area of the cerebral cortex depolarizes. And how would your brain understand that the intensity of that salty sensation is increasing? What's going to happen in that particular part of the brain? So how does your brain know that an intensity is increasing?
Depolarization causes excitation.
Yeah, so it's going to be depolarization, but that depolarization is just an action potential reaching the brain. What did we learn about action potentials? They're all the same. So how does your brain know that you're tasting like a little bit of salty something, or that you're about ready to gulp down a big margarita loaded with salt? How does it know the difference? It's that frequency of action potentials getting to that part of the cerebral cortex, right? So we call that frequency coding.
So is that bad for your system? A lot of salt?
A lot of salt is very bad for some people because it causes hypertension. And hypertension causes a lot of cardiovascular injuries. It can cause strokes, heart attacks, all kinds of things. So depending on the person, okay? Yeah, if somebody has hypertension, they shouldn't be eating any sodium at all. Okay. Do you know what hypertension is? That's high blood pressure, right? Right. Okay.
The frequency coding is the frequency of...
The frequency of action potential is directly related to the signal or the stimulus intensity. As the stimulus intensity increases, the frequency of action potentials going to some part of the cerebral cortex increases. So instead of just a blip, 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 it's what? Blip, 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 blip. That means that the intensity is high. Okay. Because all action potentials are the same. Now, the other sense is sour. And sour is due to a hydrogen ion. And hydrogen ion is the basis of what?
What?
The concentration of hydrogen ions in your body is the basis of acidity, or it's a measure of pH. If we can measure the hydrogen ion concentration, we can measure the pH. Don't forget, as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to pH? It goes which way? The pH goes down, right? It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So small numbers mean very acidic in terms of the pH scale, which means high hydrogen ion concentration. So if we put some acids in our mouth, this hydrogen ion can go through a selective ion channel. It's not selective for sodium. It is selective for hydrogen ion. So it's a much smaller kind of molecule, and it will enter the cell. And when it enters the cell, it's going to manipulate the resting membrane potential. In which way? And why? Is it going to have no change on the resting membrane potential, or will it depolarize or hyperpolarize? Depolarize. Why will it depolarize? Because it's a positive charge. Yeah, anytime you inject a positive charge into a cell, you're going to depolarize it. And hydrogen ion, of course, is a positive charge. All right, and that wave of depolarization will open these voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium will enter the cell, depolarizing it further, causing, right, that calcium causes the fusion and docking of these synaptic vesicles, releasing excitatory neurotransmitter, which then causes action potentials on this sensory neuron going to the gustatory center in the brain. So those are two sensations, and these are just due to what? Ion channels, because you don't need anything more special than that. All right, some other senses, namely sweet and umami, and the fifth one, bitter. All right, these all work through G protein coupled receptors. So now these molecules, these taste molecules, do not actually enter the cell. These are just what we call first messengers, and they're going to be converted into what inside the cell? Second messengers, right? And G proteins are really good at this, right? So that when a sugar molecule or an amino acid binds to a particular kind of receptor, either the sugar receptor or an amino acid receptor, that's going to activate this G protein coupled receptor. The G protein is going to dissociate. It's going to cause a buildup of a second messenger inside the cell. We don't have to know which one. Just call it a second messenger. That second messenger is going to work on these potassium channels. And these potassium channels are normally open. So that means without a stimulus, these potassium channels are open. So let's talk about what's happening to a cell whose potassium channels are always leaking potassium out. What's the resting membrane potential like? What happens if you, what kind of charge does potassium have? It's a positive charge. When the positive charge leaves the cell, what happens to the voltage inside the cell? It becomes more negative. What do we call that? Repolarization or hyperpolarization. So in the resting state, this cell, because potassium is always leaking out, it's hyperpolarized. So does that mean that it's being stimulated or is it being inhibited? It's being inhibited in the resting state. But when the sugar molecule binds, that potassium channel closes. So if it's inhibited in the resting state, when it becomes stimulated, right, by binding of a sugar molecule, the potassium channel closes. So now what happens? Instead of hyperpolarization, it depolarizes.
But that's on the bottom, right? That's on the second part.
That's right. So once these potassium channels close, that causes depolarization. Okay. Now what do you have on your slides? I can't see this. Hopefully I see a plus sign. Yes, there's a plus sign right there. Okay. All right, so when that cell depolarizes, then that's going to cause fusion and docking of this neurotransmitter, excitatory neurotransmitters released, and then action potentials go to the gustatory cortex. So I don't think we've run into a scheme quite like this before. But you should just know that when potassium channels are just open, that's going to hyperpolarize or inhibit the cell, and if we close those potassium channels, that's going to cause the cell to depolarize. Right? It's just going to go in the opposite direction, which is stimulating the cell. Okay, the sense of bitter, again, there has to be a G-protein coupled receptor. The first messenger is a molecule that's going to stimulate the bitter receptor. Quinine is a good example of that, as we find in tonic water. And it's going to cause dissociation of the G-protein, cause a buildup of a second messenger inside the cell. And this second messenger, okay, will have a couple effects. Right, it's going to work on the endoplasmic reticulum, and the endoplasmic reticulum is a reservoir for calcium ions. So there are calcium pumps, calcium ATP pumps, that are always pumping calcium from the cytoplasm into the endoplasmic reticulum. So calcium is very low in the cytoplasm, high in the endoplasmic reticulum, but when the second messenger binds to the smoothie arc, then calcium is released, just going down its concentration gradient. This calcium is a signal for docking and fusion of the synaptic vesicle, releasing excitatory neurotransmitter. And again, this signal, these action potentials go to the brain, the gustatory cortex, but in particular, the bitter part. So if we stimulate that part of the gustatory cortex, you're going to have the sensation of tasting something bitter. Right? And so all of your taste sensations are some combination of these five different senses. So you can taste more than five different kinds of things, but probably you could realize that some things have combinations. Well, there are things that are like sour and salty. Like what did we just talk about? Like margaritas, if you have your glass salted, of course, right? And probably a little sweet as well, okay? And that's because it's stimulating this range of gustatory receptors. Yeah.
I want to understand the one with the sweet one.
Sweet one, okay.
Yeah, okay. In the end, when the neurotransmitters are released,
then it
becomes an actual potential. And then it goes to the thalamus and then it goes to the cerebral cortex?
Yeah, I believe it. Even taste sensations have to go through the thalamus. I think the only one that doesn't have to go through there is olfaction,
okay.
Right? Because it's such an old sense. Yeah, but taste is a newer in an evolutionary sense. It has to go through the thalamus. Okay. Yeah. And then to the gustatory cortex. Okay. All right. Well, that takes us to olfaction, which is the sense of smell. And so here we see a nice nasal cavity. We see inferior nasal conchae, middle nasal conchae, superior nasal conchae is up over here. And this is where we have nerves that actually poke down from your brain through the cribriform plate. These are the olfactory foramina right here, and these nerves are actually dangling inside your nasal cavity. And this is really kind of startling because this is the only place in your body where you actually have nerves that are dangling outside your body. You don't have nerves anywhere outside your body, okay, except in your nose. And notice where they are. They're way up at the roof, the superior margin of your nasal cavity. So normally when you breathe, I suppose air just comes in at this level and goes down through the nasal pharynx into your lungs. So in order for you to smell something, or for you to get a good appreciation of odor, what do you have to do? You have to get air up into the superior part of your nasal cavity, so you have to sniff at something, right? If you're a, what do you call somebody that is a wine connoisseur? I forget, somebody who makes wine, what do we call these people, you know, or beer or something, or I suppose vinegar or whatever, right? You have to really smell these things. You have to get that aroma way up here in the superior part of your nose. And in this region right here, here we see the olfactory epithelium, and embedded in the epithelium we have these olfactory receptor neurons. And these are cilia projecting past the epithelium right into the nasal cavity. And again, these receptors right here have to have receptors, and in order for you to have the appreciation of smell, some molecule has to bind to receptors on these olfactory receptor neurons, causing some depolarization. Okay. All right, so this is, I think, the first time, yeah, this is the first time where we've actually seen some nice bipolar neurons, right? So these olfactory receptor neurons are bipolar neurons. They're not multipolar, they're not unipolar, like motor neurons or other sensory neurons. These are special sensory neurons, which are bipolar. Okay, and because they're in this part of your body, right, inside your nasal cavity, what do you think the lifespan of these neurons is? They're short. They're just hanging out in the environment, right? So if you breathe something hot, these things get singed. If you breathe in harmful chemicals, they get destroyed, right? So these cells right here have a very short lifetime. And here is one place in the nervous system where neurons are proliferated or regenerated routinely. That's pretty strange, because that's one thing that we've learned about the nervous system, is that it does not have a tendency to rejuvenate itself very well. But these bipolar neurons do a very good job of doing that. So the olfactory apparatus consists of receptor cells, support cells, and basal cells. Right, the receptor cells are bipolar neurons. Here are the bipolar neurons that send their axons up into the olfactory bulb. Can you remember where that olfactory bulb is? Remember doing a sheep brain dissection or a human brain model? That's right at the base of the brain, anterior base of the brain, underneath the frontal lobe. Right, the basal cells are stem cells that produce new receptor cells every 1 to 2 months. So these neurons are being rejuvenated. Every 2 months, you have a whole new set of receptor cells in your nose. And there's some other supporting cells that have detoxifying enzymes, because who knows what's in the air that we're actually breathing. So they're detoxifying things all the time. So, for instance, if somebody has a spinal cord injury, we've known for a long time that how does somebody recuperate from a spinal cord injury? Spinal cord injury. Are they better in 4 weeks or 5 weeks or a year or what?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Christopher Reeve never healed his spinal cord. As a matter of fact, nobody ever has. Okay, because neurons in the spinal cord don't regenerate themselves, so when the spinal cord is damaged, it's damaged for the rest of your life. You're paralyzed for the rest of your life.
But doesn't the, the fetal, when you get abortions or whatever?
Embryonic stem cells?
Yeah, stem cell research.
Well, stem cell research. That there might be some potential. It's never been shown that that can happen. All right, but where do you see stem cells on this slide? Have we talked about stem cells right here? Yeah, basal cells are stem cells. So you have stem cells that come from your own body that can rebuild neurons. Well, wouldn't it be marvelous if we could take some stem cells from somebody's nose and repopulate neurons in their spinal cord? And that would be really cool, because then you don't have to kill any embryos, right? Well, I don't know if anybody's really thought of doing that, but probably someday that might be one way to do that. And if you get neurons from one part of your body, transplant them to another part, you have to worry about rejection.
Yeah.
You know what? You don't. Mm-hmm. You don't. Yeah, because it's your body. If it's your cells in your body doesn't reject it. But if you get stem cells from an embryo that's not your body, guess what you always have to worry about? Rejection. So there's a lot of beauty in taking cells from your own body and transplanting it back in for new and novel purposes. Okay. Now, the only thing we have to be concerned about is if we take these olfactory neurons from somebody's nose to repopulate their spinal cord that's damaged, they might smell with their back. No, I'm kidding. Not true. Because why? Because these depolarizations from these cells will only give you this perception of smell if they go to where? The olfactory lobe, right? In the brain. So that's what gives you the perception of smell. Not that these depolarize, but what part of the cerebral cortex is depolarizing? Okay. Okay, so odor molecules all bind to receptors through G proteins. And the olfactory receptor gene family is huge. There's thousands of different kinds of receptors. So it's not like the five primary taste sensations. There's some people that maybe have categorized it into maybe 10 or 12 primary olfactory sensations, which might be flowery and etheric, okay, musky kinds of sensations, but there's just a lot of debate on what the primary olfactory sensations are. But nonetheless, an odorant molecule has to bind to one of these G protein-coupled receptors, which is going to cause depolarization of a neuron that goes to the olfactory cortex. Okay. Ears and hearing. Is this general or special sense? General, special. And why? Why? Yeah, you can only hear with your ears. Two locations on your body, not all over the place. All right, so just a review from anatomy. The ear has got three main sections. The outer ear, from the pinna to the tympanic membrane, including the external auditory meatus. All right, the middle ear, starting at the tympanic membrane, going over to the oval window. And this is an air space. All right, in this air space, we have some muscles, and we have three bones. The bones we call auditory ossicles, and the bones transmit vibrations from the tympanic membrane to the oval window. So it transmits sound vibrations, and sound waves are a mechanical wave. It's not electromagnetic like a light wave, but it's a mechanical kind of deformation. And you can see that the tympanic membrane is what size compared to the oval window? Is the tympanic bigger or smaller? It's bigger, right? And the oval window right here is smaller. That means that there is a step of amplification in vibrations or the transmission of energy from the air into the inner part of the ear, and the inner part of the ear is filled with fluid. And probably tonight you should try this. Fill up your bathtub or your jacuzzi or swimming pool or something, and hop in and talk to somebody, and then put your head underwater. What's going to happen when somebody's talking to you when your head is underwater? Can you hear them still? You got to try it, because guess what? You can't hear them, really, because sound and air doesn't go into the water very easily. There is a mismatch of the physical properties, and so it's difficult for sound to get into your inner ear. And it's the job of this tympanic membrane and these auditory ossicles to make sure that that sound energy actually enters the fluid of your inner ear. Okay. The other thing you notice is that there is an air passageway from the middle ear to your pharynx. What's your pharynx? What's another name for pharynx? What's your pharynx? Does anybody have a pharyngitis in here right now? Sounds more like laryngitis. Pharyngitis is what? When you have a sore throat. So what's your pharynx? It's your throat. No, your larynx is not your pharynx. Your larynx is where your vocal cords are. So when you have a laryngitis, you can't speak. When you have a pharyngitis, it's really hard to swallow because your throat is sore. Right? So this is to your throat. The auditory tube equalizes the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane because the tympanic membrane should vibrate back and forth. If pressure is high on one side or the other, it's just going to push it over to one area or the other, and it can't vibrate if it's pushed all the way over to one end. So this auditory tube equalizes the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane. Okay, so that's how sound gets into the inner ear. The inner ear has got these three different components. You have something that looks like a snail right here. And the thing that looks like a snail is the cochlea. This we call the bony labyrinth, and it's involved in this. What sense is that involved in? Anybody know? Hearing. That's hearing. Yeah, hearing. Okay. And then this part right here, this little bulge right here, is what we call the vestibule. That's important for another sense. It's the bony labyrinth for another sense in your inner ear. But it is not hearing. That's balance. And in particular, this is what we call static equilibrium. And then we have some more bony labyrinths, these canals right here that look circular. We call these the semicircular canals. That's the bony labyrinth for the other sense of equilibrium that's called kinetic equilibrium. All right, so static equilibrium is the sense of linear acceleration, moving in a straight line, forwards or backwards, up and down, right and left. All right, that's what the bony labyrinth for the vestibule is for. The semicircular canals are important for acceleration, but not linear acceleration. They don't tell you anything about linear acceleration. They tell you about angular acceleration. What's another way to think about angular acceleration? Maybe something you did over the weekend. Did you maybe close your eyes and twirl around and stop all of a sudden and open your eyes, and what happened? You're dizzy, you open your eyes, what does the world look like it's doing? Well, you have to do this in lab tonight in front of Dr. Ogoshi. Do that, and the world is going to spin. Okay? Hopefully nobody will get really sick when you do that. But don't do it in here, do it in lab. Okay, so what do we call that? What do we call that? That kind of motion. We call that angular acceleration, but it's what? It's spinning, right, or twirling. That's different than a linear acceleration. So the spinning kind of acceleration your body can monitor with the semicircular canals, not the vestibule. All right, so these are the senses that we're going to be talking about in terms of the ear. All right, so I'm going to go back now to the vestibular apparatus. So where is this vestibular apparatus located again? Inner ear, that's right. And it's filled with fluids, a couple different kinds of fluids. And we see the cochlea. What's the cochlea important for? The sense? Hearing. Right? The vestibule. We have two organs in the vestibule called the utricle and the saccule right here. These are the organs. Right? These organs, both of these contain a macula. And that's for static equilibrium. And then the semicircular canals have this little bulge right here, which people call the ampulla or an ampule. An ampule is just a tiny little bottle. And there are three organs. There's one in here, here, and here. And these contain the crista ampullaris, which are the organs for angular acceleration. All right, so we got hearing, linear acceleration, or what we call static equilibrium, and then organs over here for angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium. So let's take a look and see what these different senses tell us. And again, of course, you can see the auditory nerve and the vestibular nerve, and when these all come together, what do we call this? And you should probably remember what cranial nerve that is. That's the vestibulocochlear nerve, right? Vestibulocochlear. And that's why they simplify it. They used to just call it the auditory nerve. But it's more appropriate to call it vestibulocochlear nerve for both equilibrium and hearing. All right, the vestibular apparatus has otolith organs. These are the utricle and saccule. These together are what we call maculae. And inside the bony labyrinth, right, namely the cochlea and the vestibule and the semicircular canals, there is fluid that we call endolymph, right, when that's going to play an important role for all of these different sensations. So let's talk about static equilibrium or linear acceleration first. That occurs in the utricle and saccule within the vestibule. Okay, so in these organs, there are special receptor kinds of cells, which we call hair cells. And these are like cilia poking off the apical surface of the membrane. So we call these stereocilia. And Oh, I'm losing my cursor. Let me move up over here now. It's freaking out. Got to get closer. Okay, so where's my cursor? Still no cursor. Let me see if I can boot it back up again. Nope. That's not going to work. Okay, let me get the hard mouse out. Okay, all right, so here we have the stereo cilia poking off the cell, and there are microtubules inside these cells, right, that give them structure, and they can bend. If the stereo cilia bend toward the kinocilium, look what happens to the production of action potentials in this hair cell. Can you see this down over here? Is it high frequency or low frequency? It's high frequency. It just looks like a solid line. And when the stereo cilia bend away from the kinocilium, look what happens to the action potential frequency. It decreases. So these cells can be either stimulated or inhibited depending on how these hairs or the stereo cilia bend on top of a hair cell. Okay. All right, so let's look in particular at the utricle and saccule. They're both within the maculae. So here is one of them. So here's a macula. And can you see the hair cells right here with the stereo cilia poking up and poking up, poking up? What it's poking up into is a gelatin-like material. We call this just a gelatinous mass. And sitting on top of this gelatin are crystals of calcium carbonate. And those are we call otoliths. And anytime you see this term oto, guess what that refers to? Oto refers to ears, right? So like an otoscope is a scope that somebody would use to look into your ears. Not your eyes, but your ears. What would you use to look into your eyes called? That's an ophthalmoscope, right? So it's a little bit different kind of device. All right, so otoliths are little crystals that you have inside your ear. And they act as little weights so that gravity pulls on these crystals, right? So when your head is upright, then this gelatinous mass and these otoliths are pushing straight down on the hair cells, and they don't bend them one way or the other. But as soon as you tilt your head, for instance, if you tilt your head forward, these otoliths pull on the gelatin, and look what it does to the stereo cilia. They bend them. And that changes the rate of action potentials going to the part of the brain for static equilibrium. So you have the sense of head position. All right, so you should be aware of that gelatinous otolithic membrane with the otoliths on top and the receptor cells, right? And what's the name of these receptor cells right here? It's kind of strange. You wouldn't think you would need these cells for the sense of equilibrium. What's the name of these cells right here? It says on the slide, it says hair cell. Why is that a hair cell? Yeah, that's a support cell. But see, here's a hair cell. Here's a hair cell because it has the stereo cilia on them. Okay, so a hair cell has stereo cilia. And when you bend those stereo cilia, it will either increase or decrease the rate of action potentials going to the brain. That gives you the sense of head position. Okay, so what kind of sense of equilibrium is this? Is this a linear acceleration or angular acceleration? You know what? It's just linear acceleration. Okay? And so we call that static equilibrium. Okay, the semicircular canals are important for angular acceleration. And here are the three semicircular canals, right? You got the anterior, the posterior, and the lateral right here. And how many dimensions does space have? How many different ways can you move in space? Okay? And they're oriented within 90 degrees to each other. You can go forwards and backwards. That's one. You can go right and left. That's two. What's another way that you can go? You can go up and down. So there's three dimensions. And if you move in space at some angle, then it's just some combination of those three directions. Right? So there are three dimensions in space, and that's why we have three semicircular canals, because your inner ear can tell in what plane you are spinning at. We call that angular acceleration. So the semicircular canals provide information about rotational acceleration or spinning in these three different planes. And at the base of each of the semicircular canals, there is a little ampulla, and inside the ampulla is the organ for sending, that detects that angular acceleration, and it sends action potentials to the brain. And inside the crista ampullaris, you also have, you have a gelatinous mass right here, which is what we call the cupula. And you have these receptor cells, which are hair cells. And the hair cells have stereocilia that poke up into this gelatinous mass, right? And this gelatinous mass can bend one way or the other, and that bends the stereocilia, causing a change in action potentials in these cells, which then the cells send those action potentials to the brain. Okay, so here is the cupula. And so what's the name of the receptor cells again? They're hair cells, okay? So now the semicircular canals, right, the semicircular canals have fluid in them. So for instance, if you're standing still, like this person is right here, is this fluid moving at all? Is this fluid moving? No, if somebody's head is standing still, then the fluid is certainly not moving, right? I want to give this back to you in just a little bit. Okay, and I'll give this back to you in just a little bit. So this has to deal with one property of matter called inertia. And inertia just says that if there's any matter that's stationary, it likes to remain stationary. And also, if there is matter that's in motion, it likes to continue with that motion. It doesn't like to stop abruptly. So matter, if it's stationary, it likes to stay stationary. But if it's moving, it likes to stay in that kind of motion. So for instance, what's coming up? Thanksgiving is coming up, right? And you might have dinner at your house, or somebody, maybe even better, at maybe your mother-in-law's house or something, and they're going to put a bunch of wine bottles on the table and glasses and candles and things like that. So here I've set a table, kind of figuratively, and this is all the wine glasses and wine bottles on the table and candlesticks and things like this. And what is this right here? That's the tablecloth. So what you should do is walk over to the table after it's all set up with everything and yank the tablecloth out from underneath everything. Is everything going to spill or not? It won't spill, right? Because all of this mass has inertia, right? If you start to move it, it has a tendency to what? Stay stationary, right? So all you have to do with the table is do that. See how easy that is? It's amazingly easy, all right? And nothing will spill. And that's because this fluid has inertia. The same thing for the fluid within the semicircular canals. It just wants to stay stationary when you start moving. All right, so what kind of motion is this organ going to respond to? Linear acceleration or angular? In particular, angular acceleration. So when you start spinning, the crista ampullaris, this organ right here, since it's attached to your head, is going to start spinning. But what about the fluid inside the semicircular canals? Will it start spinning immediately? No, because it has inertia. Just like this bottle, it's going to want to stay just where those semicircular canals were located, or within there, right? But if the crista ampullaris starts moving, it's like the fluid flowing over the cupula, and then it bends the cupula, bends the stereocilia on the hair cells. That changes the frequency of action potentials going to the brain. All right, so don't forget, this fluid right here is stationary. These arrows just represent what? The twisting of your head. Now, if you twirl around for a long period of time, what happens to this fluid? What happens to that fluid? It catches up with your head, right? So if I You know, if I start moving this, and then all of a sudden I stop, oop, look what that what did that bottle do? I never did this before. That's nice. What does the bottle do when I stop the paper? Did it stop as soon as I stopped the paper?
No.
It kept moving, right? The bottle kept moving, just like that. So when a person stops all of a sudden, the crystampulera stops, but what about the fluid? It keeps moving, and it bends the cupula back the other way. That changes the action potential frequency in the other direction, and that's a very powerful sense. So when you stop spinning, how does your brain interpret that all of a sudden? The endolymph is still circulating in there, so it actually makes you feel as if the room is spinning, even though you're standing still and the room isn't spinning. Okay, because that fluid has inertia. All right, so that's the job of the crista ampullaris for what we call kinetic equilibrium or angular acceleration. Okay, so let's talk about ears and hearing. That's the third kind of sense that we have. And let's look at this diagram. So where was linear acceleration? What part of the ear is responsible for linear acceleration? Here's the whole ear. Which part of it is it? It's the vestibule, which is right here. What about kinetic equilibrium? It's the semicircular canals. What about hearing? It's the cochlea. Ah, we haven't talked about that one yet. All right, so let's talk about hearing. Angular acceleration. Yeah. I'm going to write this all on the board, tabulated in just a little bit when we get done with this. Yeah, I'll give you a nice table. That maybe is probably not in your book, but we'll talk about it. All right, so the cochlea right here is responsible for the sense of hearing. It's going to detect mechanical sound waves that are in the air. Right? So mechanical sound waves that are in the air have to enter from outside your body and get into the cochlea. It gets in by what, going through the external auditory meatus, vibrating the tympanic membrane, vibrating the auditory ossicles, which then produce that sound vibration through the oval window, and it gets into the cochlea right here. Okay, and this cochlea is really like a musical instrument. Does anybody know, anybody thought about the cochlea ever? Or anybody tell you about what the architecture of the cochlea is really like? Oh, don't leave now. Okay, it's actually like a piano. You have one in each ear. So if you hit a piano on one side, what's it going to play? It's going to play, if you strike one key, it's going to play what? One note. It's going to play one note, right? And if you strike the other end of the piano, it's going to play one note, but what's going to be the difference of those notes? One's going to be high pitch and the other's going to be low pitch, right? Okay. The cochlea works exactly the same way, right? And it doesn't look like a piano because it's all rolled up. And why is it all rolled up? Well, because it would look really silly if you had these big pianos sticking out of your head, right? So you roll it up so it fits inside the petrous region of the temporal bone, right? So anytime you take a big object, put it into a small space, you got to fold it up like convolutions on the surface of the brain. Okay, so it's a piano that's all rolled up. Okay, and this just tells you about the different auditory ossicles. Oh, okay. All right, I don't have any pictures, but you got some really good pictures in your book. So what are we going to do with that cochlea? The cochlea is what? It's all rolled up, so what do we want to do? We want to unroll it. So we're going to unroll it like that. All right, so we're looking at it from the side right now, but let's look at it from the top down. Let's look at it from the top down. What it looks like from the top down, so here is the oval window right here. So here is the oval window. And if we look at it from the top down, this is really kind of what it looks like. So this right here is the part that's right in this right here. Right? This part right here, or the end of the cochlea, this is what we call the helicotrema. And is that the thickest or the thinnest part of the cochlea? Yeah, that's the thickest. That's the widest part. So this part here is really what's sticking out. It's really wide and thick. All right, so can you... And inside this area right here, so the oval window, sound comes in through here. There's a special little tube in here. And then there's another tube in here like this. This probably will remind you of your anatomy. And I think this tube right here has got endolymph in it. This is called the scala vestibuli. I don't know if you have to know these for your test at all. This little fluid compartment has got a little bit different name. This is the scala tympani. And this one in the middle, I think, is called the scala media. It has another name associated with it. Okay. All right. I will come back to me in just a second. All right. But there's some more fluid in here. This has got... Okay. So sound comes in through the scala vestibuli. All right. Now, which part of the piano plays the low notes? The really long wires, the long thick wires, or the short thin ones? I don't know if you would know that, but the low frequencies are the? Are actually the long thick ones, vibrate at a slow frequency. So that corresponds to the helicotremor region. So this is the low frequency region over here. So this is where low notes, vibrations come in, they go across this membrane into the scala tympani, and then out, what is this window here called? I drew it perfectly. If this is the oval window, what's this? That's the round window. So that sound energy comes in your ear, and if it came in your ear and didn't have any place to go, it'd blow your ear up. So that energy is released out the round window right here. And when the sound energy goes across this thing, which we're going to talk about in just a second, okay, then it's going to give you the perception of a low note. But if it goes across way over here, closer to the oval window, guess what kind of frequency you're going to hear? This is going to be a high pitch, right, or a high frequency. And in the middle is going to be what? Like mid-range kinds of notes. And that's exactly how a piano is built, right, with the big, long, thick strings over here and the tiny, tiny, short ones over here. Okay, and depending on, all right, so the organ that's inside this region right here is called the organ of Corti. This is the organ of Corti. And what it looks like, okay, is that there are a couple membranes. Okay, I think this is called the tectorial membrane. In the organ of Corti. And as sound goes across this tectorial membrane, which is in the organ of Corti, it's going to do what to this tectorial membrane? As sound goes past it. The sound energy, it's going to vibrate it. Right, just like when your vocal cords produce sound, they vibrate. So the tectorial membrane is going to vibrate, and attached to the tectorial membrane are some of these cells that have these cilia touching the tectorial membrane. So when the tectorial membrane vibrates, guess what happens to these hairs? They vibrate, they bend. So what kind of cell does that look like? That looks like a hair cell. All right, so these are hair cells. So they're just a series of hair cells within the organ of Corti, depending on the exact location within the organ of Corti, from the distance from the oval window to the helicotrema, it's going to give you the sense of different frequencies when that sound energy passes through there. High frequencies over here, these hair cells are going to depolarize. Low frequency will depolarize these hair cells over here. And then all of these send action potentials to the brain. All right, and in particular, what part of the brain? Anybody remember? The Yeah, in the temporal lobe, the auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. And so what do you really have in the temporal lobe? You actually have pianos in your temporal lobe, right? And when these depolarize over here, you hear a low note. And when these depolarize over here, you hear a high-frequency note. And if this one and this one and this one depolarize, you hear a... What do you hear? What do you hear? What do you perceive when you hear three notes in the right proportion? That would be like a chord. Okay? Okay. So, you have hair cells. So this right here, this structure right here is what we call the organ of Corti. And that's for hearing. That's inside the cochlea.
So what would be the cerebellum and all that stuff? Where's the cerebellum?
Okay. I might have to look this up. But this right here is endolymph. And here is perilymph. And here is perilymph. That's perilymph. Okay? And that sound just goes from perilymph into the endolymph and then out the perilymph again. I might have that backwards. Your book might tell you. You think you saw that? Okay, let me look real quick. Oh, look at that picture. Nice. Perilymph. Ah, I did it right. Perilymph. Page 276. Okay, the cochlear duct, which is this right here. Cochlear duct contains endolymph. Yeah. So figure 10.21 actually shows a nice piano that I drew on the board. My diagram is better, but... Okay, it's close. The book is close. Yeah, 276, 277, 278. Okay. And that even shows the part of the temporal lobe that depolarizes. That's figure 10.25. So the yellow represents high frequencies and blue, is that blue way out over here? The blue represents low frequencies in the organ of, in the temporal lobe, in the primary auditory cortex. All right, so let's tabulate. I'm going to erase this diagram. Hopefully you've taken a picture of it. And let's tabulate the ear. All right, so what kind of senses do we appreciate with our ear? What kind of senses? Auditory is what sense? I like auditory. That auditory is okay. So ear. E-A-R. Ear. What are the three senses? Hearing. Hearing, and then balance. What kind of balance? Equilibrium is balance, I would say. What kind of equilibrium? Static. All right, so static is one. Okay, and kinetic. Kinetic. All right, so static is what kind of acceleration? Linear. Linear acceleration. Ooh, okay, a little long-winded. Linear acceleration. Kinetic equilibrium is angular or twisting, twirling, something like that. Angular. I'm just going to abbreviate acceleration. Okay. And these senses are housed first within a bony labyrinth. So for these senses within the ear, what's the bony labyrinth responsible for these three senses? For hearing, what's the bony labyrinth? It's the snail, which is cochlea. Make sure I spell it right, okay? Double check my spelling. Cochlea. What about for balance? Don't forget, you got what? Static and kinetic. So let's do static first. What's the bony labyrinth for static equilibrium? Vestibule. What about for kinetic equilibrium? Kinetic equilibrium? Are you guys getting a quiz on this today?
The
No? Too bad. Okay, you're going to do this tonight? Good. So, vestibule for static, what about kinetic? Semicircular canals, yeah. Semicircular canal. All right, don't forget you got three of them. All right, now, so that's a bony labyrinth. What about the organ? The organ that transduces that particular modality of energy into action potentials. What's the organ responsible for doing that? So inside the bony labyrinth, there's another little structure that converts linear acceleration or sound energy or angular acceleration into action potentials. What's the organ for doing that? Hearing is organ of Corti. So organ of Corti is not in the vestibule, not in the semicircular canals. It's in the cochlea. What about the organs for static equilibrium inside the vestibule? These are both called, there's two of them. Right, these are the maculae, and there you've got two maculae. One is called the utricle, and the other is the saccule. Those are the organs. And what about the organ for kinetic equilibrium? Can you picture what's going on in here? You should be able to picture in your mind what that organ of Corti looks like. It's got what the basilar membrane and the tectorial membrane. It's got those cells in there. The macula has got what? That gelatinous mass with a crystal sitting on top of it. And the semicircular canals have got the crista ampullaris. Crista ampullaris. And that has a gelatinous mass. What's the name of that gelatinous mass in the crista ampullaris called? It starts with a C. It's called the cupula. The cupula. Okay. All right. Then lastly, what about the receptor cells? So what are the cells that actually transduce that energy? The cells that make up the organ of Corti, that initiate action potentials going to the brain. What are those called? No, not in the ear. Hair cells? Are you sure? Yeah, you're right. It's strange. They're hair cells. All right, so the receptor cells in the organ of Corti are hair cells. What about in the utricle and saccule? What are the cells? The receptor cells called? Oh, I showed you. Now you're really pulling my leg. Hair cells again? Yeah. As a matter of fact, you're right. There are hair cells too. Hair cells. Right? Because when those stereocilia bend, that changes action potentials going to the brain. What about the receptor cells in the crista ampullaris? What are those called? They're hair cells. They're all hair cells. Okay, so these generate, or they produce generator potentials, which then set up action potentials in, right, either the auditory nerve or the vestibular nerve that go to that part of the brain that gives your brain the sense of hearing or equilibrium. So I think you should be probably amazed at how your body uses the exact same kind of cell, almost, slight modifications, to give you these different senses. And is this the sense of acceleration anything similar in your perception to sound? Is acceleration remotely similar to your sense of sound? Not at all, right? But it is still all produced by the same kinds of receptor cells, right? Your body has just adapted these cells for different purposes. So, I don't know. I find that kind of amazing. Okay. Okay, now vision. Oh, we probably won't get done tonight. Vision. All right, vision. Is this a special sense or general sense? Special. Only your two eyeballs. And vision, your sense of vision can detect energy in the form of electromagnetic radiation, which is the same thing basically as a microwave or a radio wave or TV wave, except it's at a different frequency. So we can't see radio waves or microwaves, but we can see other forms of electromagnetic radiation, which is in the visible light spectrum. So a spectrum just shows you different energies based on wavelength. All right, so the longer the wavelength, the higher the frequency. Wavelength, nanometer. Yeah. The larger the wavelength, the slower the frequency, the lower the frequency. Okay, so these are very long waves over here. These are very short waves over here. High frequency, low frequency. So radio waves are very low frequency. And the energy in this electromagnetic radiation goes as the wavelength. So these are low energy. This is low energy over here in the radio waves. And as the frequency gets higher and higher and higher, right, then the energy gets higher and higher and higher as well. So gamma radiation and x-rays, these are very high energy. They're damaging to biological tissues because they're such high energy. And kind of in the middle here is visible light. And that's relatively high energy, but it's not really too damaging to skin. But it is sort of damaging. What do we produce in our bodies to prevent damage from, okay, visible light spectrum and in particular ultraviolet light? What does our body produce to prevent damage from these forms of electromagnetic radiation? There are certain cells called melanocytes. What does a melanocyte produce? Yeah, melanin, right, that pigment, to absorb that wavelength right there so it's not damaging. Your body doesn't produce any pigments that can absorb X-rays or gamma rays, right, although your bones are kind of opaque to them. All right, so this is the visible light spectrum, or you could, what's another name that you could use this right here? You've all seen this. You could call this a rainbow, okay? You could call that a rainbow, or the visible light spectrum. And so the sun basically puts out all of these different wavelengths, and this is what we can use to see objects. And so that's a visible light spectrum. Some of us can see all these colors, some can't. I'll just write this on the board. Here's a guy's name, Roy G. Biv. If you ever have to remember, right, the colors of a rainbow and what colors come next to each other, okay, just remember this guy's name. Because what does R stand for? Red, orange, yellow. Red? Okay. Orange? Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Yellow? Mm-hmm. Yellow I can see. Right, and then so G, green? Mm-hmm. Blue? Indigo? Violet. Okay, so that's how it should play out. So you have special photoreceptors in your eyes that can convert this kind of energy, color energy, into the kind of signal that your brain appreciates. What kind of signal does your brain appreciate? Action potentials, right? So the retina is the part of the eye that converts light energy into action potentials, and that goes to your visual cortex where you have the perception of light, right, and even the perception of color. Okay, what lobe of the brain is that? Occipital lobe, right? That's the occipital lobe. Okay. All right. What? Before we get there, there are some accessory structures in the eye. Accessory structures don't allow you the perception of light, but they help in the functioning of your eye. All right. So they might protect your eye somehow, or actually help you to see things. So first we're going to talk about the pupil, and the pupil right here is not really a structure, but it's a hole in a structure. The iris is the colored part of your eye, right? And the pupil is the hole in the iris, and this is the aperture by which light can enter your eye. So if the light is very bright, your pupil is constricted. When the light is very, very dim, right, then your pupil gets large, right? We call that when your pupil is dilated. All right, so the pupil constricts by contraction of the circular muscles. So we can see that the iris right here has two different kinds of muscles. Here are the circular muscles, and then here are the radial muscles. All right, so in dim light, right, the radial muscles constrict, pulling the pupil open. And in bright light, the circular muscles contract or constrict, and that constricts the or closes off the pupil, protecting your eye from very, very bright light. All right, so these are, now do you control this with a somatic motor neuron or autonomic? Do you control your pupil diameter, or does it just happen automatically? Automatically. So it is the autonomic nervous system. And so how many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? It's got two, sympathetic and parasympathetic, right? Okay. So for the radial muscles, they're stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system, and the parasympathetic nervous system stimulates the circular smooth muscles. And of course that makes sense, because what is the sympathetic division in common everyday language noted for? What kind of nervous system is that? Fight or flight, right? So when you're dealing with a harmful, stressful circumstance, right, your pupils are going to dilate so that you can get a lot of light in to perceive that particular threat. All right, so that's one way to realize that. So sympathetic causes pupil dilation, parasympathetic causes pupil constriction. Okay. All right, accommodation. We can talk about accommodation, then we're probably going to have to take a break. If we look at the eye, all right, here is kind of a nice picture of an eyeball. This is not a bad one. You've got a better one in your book. But here is maybe a transverse section of the eye looking down from the top. So this is just a little review from anatomy. Remember the layers of the eye, the sclera, the choroid, and the retina right here. The sclera is the white of your eye. That's the toughest part. You maybe did an eyeball dissection. That's very, very tough. That's as tough as shoe leather. It gives shape to the eye. And then the inner chamber here is filled with vitreous humor, right? Vitreous humor is like a jelly. Here is the lens. And the lens can change shape because there's a muscle called the ciliary muscle or ciliary body right here that can contract or dilate. And there are tendons that go from the ciliary muscle to the lens. And we call that the suspensory ligament. Right, or maybe I should just call these ligaments. So here's a suspensory ligament, and here you can see that the lens can either be very flat or it can be very thick. And when it gets thick, it kind of bulges, right? And have we ever talked about this in class before? No? Okay. All right. Well, what does that do? The lens is important so that by the time light reaches the retina, things are in focus. If things are out of focus, what is your world going to look like? Okay. It's going to be blurry, right? Okay. Well, what the lens does is that it offers some focusing power, but it allows you to see things close up or far away, but not both at the same time. So, for instance, if you put your hand out in front of you and look at your fingertips, right? Look at your fingertips. Tell me how the fingertips look compared to the back of the room. Fingertips are in focus? Yeah. What about the rest of the room? Blurry. All right, keep your fingertips out there. Now look at the room. What do your fingertips look like? Oh, yeah, they're blurry, but now the room looks in focus. Okay? So you can only really appreciate your world at one depth at a time. You can't see everything in focus at one time. So you have to pick your attention to what depth you want to focus on. And that job is performed by the lens because it changes shape, right? And that's due to the ciliary body right here and right here. That process of changing your distance at which you focus at is called accommodation. So accommodation is looking up close or farther away. And guess what happens to this lens as you get older? It gets tougher. It loses resiliency. That's right. So it doesn't like to bend. It takes slower to bend. So for instance, if you're driving down the freeway, all right, and somebody's driving 20 miles an hour on the freeway, the 405. What can you tell me about that person? Yeah, you could do this to them, but they won't even see you, so it won't matter. What could you tell me about that person that's going like 20 miles an hour down the freeway? Okay. They're probably an elderly person, right? And an elderly person, what are they concerned about? Getting a traffic ticket, because if they get a traffic ticket and they're in their 70s or 80, what happens to their driver's license? It gets yanked, right? So somebody that's elderly is very concerned about speeding. So where are they looking? They're looking at their speedometer, which is on their dashboard. All right, so is that far away vision or close vision? That's close, all right? All right, so that elderly person is saying, okay, I'm not speeding. Ah, but then they get worried. What do they get worried about? Okay, maybe crashing into something or maybe missing their exit on the freeway, because if you miss the exit, then you got to go farther down the freeway, and that's like the last place you want to be anyway. All right, so you look up from the dashboard from your speedometer, and you look down, all right, and what do you see? It's blurry. 1001, 1002, and then all of a sudden it kind of pops into focus. And then the person goes, oh, there's my exit there. I haven't passed my exit yet. I feel good. But immediately what happens to them? What are they worried about next?
Speeding.
Am I speeding? So where do they look? Down at the dashboard. And what do they see? Nothing. It's blurry, right? 1001, 1002. It pops into focus. And they say, oh, good, I'm only going 15 miles an hour. I'm not going to get a speeding ticket. Okay, but then what are they worried about? The exit. So they look down the road, what do they see?
Blurry,
right? Because what? That lens just takes longer to accommodate when you change your distance of focus. All right, so the bottom line is when you see those viejitos out there, just be really kind to them because when they're driving, they can't see anything, right? So just stay out of their way. Okay? Because that's one thing that happens when that lens gets stiff. You just can't accommodate. So you got to know what accommodation is. Right? So accommodation is not just raw focusing, it's what? Changing your depth of focus. Okay? All right. Well, you guys got lab. Unless you want to have me give Dr. Ogoshi a call, and we can just stay down here and have lecture for another couple hours. Okay, well, he'd probably be really disappointed. And we'll miss you guys. So we can't do that. So we got to finish up vision next time we got the test. We got an exam. Okay, and don't forget, after the exam, I'll just grade your papers right away.